Have you ever had a fantastic experience with healthcare? What about a not so great one? Well, here at the Alinea Life Podcast, we're going to talk about it. The Alinea Life Podcast, a production of the Alinea Collective, exists to be a public resource to you, the listener, who at some point or another has been a patient of this crazy thing we call the healthcare system. Co-hosts and doctors of physical therapy, William Mills and Joey Rosie, interview experts in the fields of physical rehabilitation, fitness, and medicine, as well as the athletes and patients, on their experiences with the good, the bad, and the ugly of healthcare. That's better. I was happy with that one.
The topics discussed in this podcast should not be considered medical advice or a means of diagnosis. If you're in need of medical attention or advice, seek a licensed healthcare professional. The conversations in the Alinea Life Podcast are intended for adult audiences only, and though we keep most topics professional, there is occasional strong language.
So I'm hanging out in Zach Long's garage right now, aka the Barbell Physio, in Charlotte, North Carolina. What are we talking about today, Joseph?
We're going to talk about anything and everything barbell related and the bridge between traditional therapy and sports therapy as it's going to be known for here in the future.
Don't call it the bridge, first of all, because there shouldn't be no bridge. This should be basic knowledge for all physical therapists working with active individuals. One thing I cannot stand is people who, I don't mean this negatively, against you. I stand when somebody says, hey, Zach, you're doing a great job of bridging the gap. There shouldn't be a freaking gap. It's pathetic that we don't know, as a outpatient active population clinic, how to fully break out an individual squat pattern or deadlift pattern.
Well, I completely agree with that.
I can understand that everybody doesn't need to know the depth of kipping pull-ups or the Olympic lifts to the extent that I do, but good grief, we should all have a really back and forth knowledge of the squat and deadlift. Just the same as we're taught how to analyze somebody's gait in school. You can learn a heck of a lot more by analyzing somebody's squat than you can by doing manual muscle testing of their lower extremities.
So I very much agree with that.
I think it's going to be really slow because right now everything that's taught in schools is based on licensure exams.
Yeah.
Which is unfortunate in that so many schools are having to put all their content towards that goal and preparing people to be general physical therapists and not preparing them to be the best physical therapist possible as a new grad in their area. So then it becomes up to new grads to get out and study that stuff. There's just not that much time in a 3-year curriculum to get to all of that.
So speaking on that, do you think it should be required that people do a residency based off of the field that they want to go into? Because that was proposed by, I believe, the APTA last November.
Not until we do something significant to change the income of physical therapists. We're already going to school for 7 years with most people coming out with over $100,000 in student loans. I get asked on a weekly basis, at least by student PTs, do you think I should do residency? And I argue that I absolutely believe that a residency would make you a much better physical therapist. But I don't believe right now we're at a point where we can justify the financial investment that it takes to do a residency. I think we're far from it. I don't think we're proving that we are paying physical therapists enough to justify a doctorate in physical therapy where it takes people 7 years to get that degree. Hell, I don't think we could justify undergraduate degrees right now with the amount of liberal arts classes that people have to take that don't do anything long-term towards their development in the profession they want to do. I had no reason to waste money taking a class on the history of rock and roll or beginning ceramics. I understand my need to take some basic English classes in undergrad, but I didn't need to take a lot of that. I could have cut my undergraduate degree down to 2.5 years and gotten everything I needed out of it, gotten my 3-year doctorate. Then maybe we talk when I'm only 5.5 years in about doing a residency or something like that. If you've taken my student loans down to where I didn't graduate with over $100,000, making under $100,000 in my first job. So until we fix all of that, no, I don't think we need to be adding anything to what we're currently doing.
That's so funny. I was actually having that conversation today with one of my my patients who was talking about her granddaughter trying to get into therapy. And I said very similar things that you just said. I myself actually walked out of school with over $200,000 in debt. And I was actually going to do a residency, and I opted out because they were going to pay me $55,000 a year. And I thought that was crap, but how am I going to pay for anything? So I went the traveler's route, where to make what I make as a traveler, you would roughly have to start off making $125,000 a year. And you don't see that many therapists with X amount of years, yet alone somebody just coming out of school. So I completely agree with everything you just said.
It's not the greatest situation we have ourselves set up for right now, unfortunately. But we've got a lot of other positives going for us.
So
what are some of those?
We get to spend more time with patients than anybody else in the healthcare field. First of all, we're doing a great job of trying to put forth more and more research. We've got a lot of people trying to push our profession forward. We've got too much infighting within that, but I think the time and the things that we can do as far as getting people moving better and potentially working more on healthy lifestyle changes like exercise and nutrition and sleep and things that we can dig into with the amount of time we have can help us impact more than just the injury people are coming to see us for. I don't know that anybody else is in that situation. The current medical field, MDs, aren't in that situation right now. They certainly don't have the time to start addressing some of these bigger healthcare issues with people when your primary care physician only has an average of 6 minutes with their patients. So they can't dive into much more than figuring out what the best drug to cover up this problem is and give them a sheet that says, hey, maybe you should eat better, or refer them to a nutritionist. I think we're in a situation where we can potentially have much bigger lifestyle changes on people.
Sure. I mean, in all the clinics I've been in, you know, I've been in roughly, I change every 3 months. Some clinics you'll see, you go into some hospital clinics that are one-on-one, some are, you know, two-on-one. And I've been in other clinics that you're seeing four people at a time. I've been at one that I saw seven at a time once. You hardly can even say anything to these people. You know, traditionally, physical therapy sessions last most often between 45 minutes to an hour. You know, obviously that can change. You know, you want to give all this knowledge and information, all these holistic ways of coping with the whole body based on sleep, nutrition, everything that you just mentioned. What is a way that we can do that but still be, you know, financially sound for a company when reimbursement and everything is dropping?
I mean, at this point for me, it's discussions during manual therapy. It's discussions during exercise interventions or during rest, because we don't specifically get super reimbursed for those things. I think that's stuff that down the road we'll have to argue for more. I think that's things like, so I'm an instructor for the Institute of Clinical Excellence, and one of our partners is the APHPT, Applied Population Health and Prevention Therapies. Great physical therapist by the name of Mike Eisenhart has started this program where his PT clinic up in New York has gone about trying to solve the healthcare issues that are currently plaguing our country by getting to them before they become big issues, getting to people that are on the bubble of becoming chronic health problems and addressing that before they develop these chronic health problems by getting them exercising and things like that. That would be a great resource for people to look up, or just listen to this podcast by Mike Eisenhart, somebody y'all need to reach out to and talk to. Freaking brilliant. But yeah, it's going to take some, to get really deep into that would take some serious shifts in how business is run. And there's a lot of PTs right now that are doing population health stuff by reaching out to corporations, going into corporations and trying to get ahead of these things by offering nutritional support, exercise support to people in these corporations. Or when somebody tweaks their low back, rather than immediately going to your primary care physician, you know, they just pop in and talk to this physical therapist that's part of the corporation. And they're not even doing treatment. They're just saying, hey, Joe, I know your back's really bothering you right now. It's really, really ticked off. I want you to just keep moving as much as possible. Wait a week before you go to your primary care. If in a week it's still bugging you, then yeah, let's go see your primary care, but just give it a week. And the amount of money that you can save by simply doing something as easy as that is talking somebody off the ledge and saying, just wait one daggum week, is millions of dollars that could potentially be saved for corporations. Don't quote me on this number, but I think Mike's organization has found that for every $1 a corporation invests into them, they save the company $9. Again, don't quote me on that, but it's just ridiculous what they can do from a population health standpoint there. I'm just talking people off the ledge and saying, wait.
Yeah, sure. That's significant.
That's crazy. Like flip value.
Heck yeah, man. If you give me $1 and I can return $9 for you, that's off the chart. I'll do that all day long.
Yeah.
That's true.
Hey, we haven't talked about barbells yet.
That's true.
So let's switch gears. How did you get the idea to start your Instagram account? Did it kind of come from your desire to want to have your own impact in healthcare and like push the field of physical therapy forward?
Yeah. So almost exactly 3 years ago, I sat down and wrote my vision statement for what I felt like God had called me to do in my life. And based on that vision statement, which I've kept with me every day since then, I knew that the job I was in wasn't fulfilling that vision. And so I left that job, took a job with Carolina Sports Clinic, where we were hanging out today, and loved working for that company, loved the patients I was seeing, but it took me a really long time to get my caseload built up. And in my position there, I get paid a percentage of every dollar that I bring into the company rather than having a salary. Which can be a great deal, but also when you're building up, it can be really tough. And I had a really tough few first months and basically was almost out of money.
Yeah.
I've been writing on my website for a long time, but I kept looking at my vision statement and my sister kept bugging me about needing to reach out and do more with what I was currently doing. And so I just got on Instagram and I started posting the first, when I first started doing it, I did one post a day for 45 days and it just grew and grew and grew and grew. And I've stayed consistent with it and it just continues to grow bigger and bigger.
Now, when you say staying consistent, you still do one a day?
I do 5 to 6 a week. Usually skip one day a week.
Mm-hmm. What is your content get its inspiration from?
The patients I see.
Yeah.
Or the things that I'm currently working on for myself. Mm-hmm. I don't ever like make up exercises for the heck of making up exercises to post on there.
Yeah.
But if I find a problem in the clinic with a patient, and I find a solution that specifically hits that in a different way than I think it's been presented before, that those are things that I like to share. So a lot of times it's cool to go on and see exercises that I've done that I know a long time ago, I was one of the first, if not the first person to start sharing and to just see it get really, really popular and things like that.
That's awesome. Do you use these exercises as like a video library that you can send to patients? So if like you give that as their HEP, like their prescription, do you say, you know, here's this link, this link, this link, here's how to do it in case you have questions later?
Yep, absolutely. Just becomes a giant home exercise program. So, you know, if you look at all the exercises that I post on social media and you go to a random home exercise program website, you won't find those on there. It's just, I've never been like, all right, every shoulder pain, let's go do TheraBand external rotations right at your side. That's just never been an exercise I've really prescribed much. So I get emails all the time from people like, hey, you want to join our home exercise program? No, because you won't have any of the stuff that I actually program. So yeah, it's just a lot easier for me to go use my Instagram or YouTube, whatever.
So a lot of the people that you're seeing we're assuming that they have access to, you know, gym equipment such as a barbell and plates and various things.
A lot of them do. Some of them don't. So it's just about having a big enough database that I can ask somebody with any issue, you know, what equipment do you have readily accessible? Well, I go to the gym twice a week and I have all this. Awesome. I want you doing something a little bit more frequently than that. So what do you have at home? Maybe they don't even have anything. Then I can still come up with something to strengthen their legs with no equipment at home, or have them grabbing soup cans and putting soup cans inside of a grocery bag if I need to load up some way like that. So I just try to have as huge of an exercise database as possible so that no matter what equipment somebody has, I can get the job done.
Those are all great things I have. Really good things.
What would you say is we're getting a beer switch.
Oh man, Will's already behind. Typical.
I'm almost done with my first one, Joseph. You made me lose my train of thought. How did you get into So you've written articles for the CrossFit Journal?
Correct.
How'd you get into that?
So in physical therapy school, mm-hmm. I was really into lifting, really into the Olympic lifts. We had to do a talk on biomechanics of the weightlifting exercise, the snatch. And a new CrossFit Journal published a lot of different informational articles. So I just reached out to him and said, hey, I've done this presentation before. I think it'd be an excellent article to give some of your readers, your coaches, your athletes a more in-depth knowledge of the mechanics of this movement. Would you be interested? They said yes. So I wrote that article for them. And after I wrote, you know, one or two more for them, they started to see the value that I could bring to them. And so they just kept asking me for more and more. And we're probably up to somewhere around 15 articles now, would be my guess, that I've written.
Cool. Where can people find those? Are they all in the CrossFit Journal? Or
Journal.crossfit.com.
Okay.
The journal is now a paid journal, mm-hmm. but if you search for, if you just Google CrossFit Journal Zach Long, most of those older articles are still outside of their paywall, so you'd still be able to read those. So for instance, like there's a, if you're treating a lot of CrossFitters, if you're, or you're a CrossFitter yourself listening to this, there's a 9 or 10 part series that I wrote with Pamela Gagnon, who's one of the head coaches for CrossFit Gymnastics. And we basically broke down all the gymnastics movements from, you know, take a pull-up, for example. If you can't do a strict pull-up, what's that going to impact performance-wise? What are the steps that you need to take towards that? If you're not taking those steps, what are the potential issues you're setting yourself up for? Or if you're working on your handstand push-ups, Pamela talks about the strength needs of that, and I'll break out what are some of the mobility demands of the handstand push-up. So if you don't have great shoulder flexion mobility, it's going to significantly impact your ability to perform that movement. So we just broke all those movements down over the course of it to provide a lot of information that's really valuable for anybody associated with CrossFit.
How many CrossFitters do you treat on a weekly basis?
I told you beforehand, don't ask me specific questions after no data.
Just around.
I would say that at least probably a third of my evaluations are CrossFitters. Mm-hmm. Maybe a little bit more when we add in weightlifters or powerlifters. I mean, today we saw 10 or 12 people. 2 or 3 of them are CrossFitters. The thing with CrossFitters, though, is I might eval them out of them. They get better really, really easy, and they're super motivated to do what you give them to do at home. So a lot of issues that's going to take a 50-year-old woman that plays tennis 5 times a week, who's going to be a little less motivated to do her home exercise program, aren't going to plague the CrossFitter who I know they have to warm up when they go in. So literally all I got to do is program their home exercise program as part of their warm up, and it makes it really easy for them to get it done. And they get it done because they want to get back to doing everything they love doing at the gym.
Yeah.
So it's pretty easy to get CrossFitters better, especially when you have a full understanding of the movements that they're performing, when you can do things that are going to keep them active. Because mm-hmm. I think bad stuff happens when you make people stop. So if somebody's back hurts when they squat, well, I'm going to try to find a different squat variation that they can do without hurting their back. Because I think that movement and loading with a load that's not irritating already pissed off tissues is going to help their healing process happen faster.
Mm-hmm.
So having the ability to substitute a lot of things for them is going to help speed up their recovery process in a lot of ways, or having an in-depth knowledge of, you know, the mechanics of a snatch might help if they're having snatch specific pain. Now, I've been able to treat a number of people who saw other rehab providers and got significantly better working with those rehab providers. But when it came to getting back to 100%, back to working on some of the higher level skills, they couldn't get there. And that was because of some, you know, minute biomechanical factors that were overloading certain tissues that were already sensitized, using fancy words there for the people that are going to jump on this podcast and chew me out for using nocebos. But having a unique understanding of those movements can help me, you know, work on some specific ways to spread load across multiple tissues. So that this person can get back to doing the activities that they enjoy better.
So what if somebody isn't in pain and you do your screening process and you're looking at the way they squat the way they squat, are you going to, you know, try to give them pointers or try to correct them and better their movement patterns and try to educate them on that realm as well if there's no pain? Or do you leave the, if it's don't broke, don't fix it?
I've got a window of window that I'll let them move in that is not quote optimal. So somebody might have a little, especially like my elite Olympic lifters, like I train multiple, I work with multiple national level Olympic lifters. They all have valgus when they squat, when they come out of the hole. And there's a couple of reasons why that might happen, but do I mess with it with them? Absolutely not. They are a finely tuned machine that's working at top caliber. I'm not changing anything performance wise with them, or very few things am I going to change performance wise with them. You know, if it's a weekend warrior and we have some evidence that this certain movement dysfunction might lead to increased risk of injuries, and it's a minor movement in that direction, it kind of depends what's in front of me. A lot of times if it's minor, I'm not going to touch it. If it's major, I may touch it from a health perspective, but probably more importantly, the things that we think of as movement dysfunctions that we typically think lead to injury are also probably going to be things that are going to lead to poor performance in that movement.
Sure.
So when I correct that, I'm probably going to go about it more from a performance perspective than I am from an injury perspective, because I don't want to create thoughts in their mind on, oh my gosh, if I ever round my back in a deadlift, I'm going to hurt it. Because you know what? I did a max deadlift 3 weeks ago. My back was rounded as crap. And I'm daggone proud of that max deadlift. And I'm happy with the weight I got. I didn't put it on Instagram because I didn't want to deal with the BS of 20 people commenting about how I'm going to blow my back out. And actually, I'm embarrassed that I didn't put it up, because I should put it up and just told them to
watch the grenade blow up.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, you should do it. You know, I'm actually a competitive powerlifter. And one of the things that I see people that would my class, which I used to compete in 181, now I do the 165 class. There was a guy who competed, and he deadlifted 709 at 163 something, which is insane amount of weight. Mm-hmm. And his back would, and a lot of people in this level, but their backs round so much, and you still see them performing at such an elite level. And you know, it's on a different end. You see people who would argue, oh well, you know, you got to keep your spine so straight, but they're young and they're healthy, so they can do it. And I completely agree that, you know, we need to get away from that and focus more on if you are talking of a performance based and a prehab based, which are in essence almost the same thing, but how you approach it.
There's a lot of gray. We certainly don't have a lot of answers to different things in this area yet. Mm-hmm.
Do you think the real, so for a powerlifter who lifts with a rounded back, or if you're doing performing a max lift in your back rounds, do you think, like, what would you say to someone who would disapprove of that? Would your argument be that you've spent enough time building up tissue tolerance?
Yeah. So there was a girl a while back that was doing a competition at a local gym. And I want to say that this girl pulled mid 400. It was just an impressive deadlift for a girl. And it went viral. It got put on multiple big Instagram accounts, and she was just getting hated on. And somebody told me that she was getting hated on. I don't know her personally, but I know a lot of her friends in the gym that she works out. And so I basically went onto her video and commented and just said, anybody that's criticizing you for your rounded back one rep max deadlift is an asshat who's never pulled a true one rep max deadlift, and just left it at that.
He just threw the
grenade. Just threw that out and walked away.
And did you ever go back to see?
There was a lot of comments back, like positive around that. But, you know, maybe she is putting herself at a little bit increased risk. And certainly I do want the vast majority of people's deadlifts to be with a flat back. But you're never going to hear me when somebody hits a PR with, quote, dysfunctional technique, such as a rounded back, you're never going to see me criticize them for that. I'm going to congratulate them for hitting a personal record. It turned out that was a girl that had a horrible day, and had a horrible week. And I think she wrote in a later post it was one of the worst weeks of her life. And so for people to then come behind her and give her a hard time about this PR, which was the highlight of her week and probably something that turned her week around when she really needed a big win, is just screwed up.
Yeah.
Get off your freaking high horse.
You know, that's fantastic. You know, I myself, when I first got out of PT school, I was so much more of that Nazi, and I wish I could go back, and I wish more people were putting out content like there is now, so I could have been better a few years ago. and how much my own mindset and everything has changed in the past year. And I wish I could go back and change my own self, and I can't. You know, all we can do is grow. Mm-hmm. And I think as a profession, we're doing, like you said, a great job, but we have so much interprofessional conflict, and we're fighting with each other a lot more than we are promoting each other, doing a lot of things. So I think it's a great point to bring up.
Do you think as a profession, physical therapy, because we can't like truly define across the board how someone would assess a squat or a deadlift, do you think that plays into the overall identity crisis that PTs talk about?
No, I don't. You can make good arguments for the need to have some sort of standardized assessment of certain movement patterns or certain regions of the body, but I'm much more successful in my clinic because the physical therapist that I work side by side with most days of the week treats highly different than I do. And so because we have this different way of assessing certain things, a different way of treating certain things, we're able to catch a lot of the faults and holes that each other has. So things that I'm not good at, she's really good at. So we're able to help more people out because of these different viewpoints of looking at human movement and rehabilitation.
So you would say the variability is a positive?
I think the variability is positive. I think there are probably some things that are principles of that, but the variability around it is good.
So with variability, if you are the patient, should you be coming and seeing maybe multiple clinicians then, and that way you get different perspectives, or you think it's better that they stay with you?
No, that they need to stay with one person or one team. So for instance, if you're seeing me and this is something that we need to work through over a long period of time, and I don't need to see you every week to work on it, and I just need to tell you, hey, these are the things to work on for the next month, then I have no problem with you going and seeing a massage therapist or go seeing a chiropractor who's going to do some ART, some things like that are going to provide some temporary relief. But I just need you to know that when it comes to this certain area of your rehab, when it comes to your exercise prescription and the things that are going to create long-term changes, I need you listening to me, not listening to me and the massage therapist telling you something and the chiropractor telling you something else. You got to have ways of figuring out who the right person to make certain calls are in situations like that.
Sure.
What? I don't want somebody seeing two different therapists that's giving them two different home exercise programs. One person looking at it from a PRI perspective, the other person looking at it from a, we need to make these tissues stronger and more robust.
What are your thoughts on PRI?
Next question.
You know, that's so cool. You know, at the same time, being a therapist myself and a lifter, you know, I wish it were more norm for me to be able to come to say you and say, you know, I want you to do an assessment on me. Look at how I'm doing, moving. You know, if you think I have some limitations in my glenohumeral joint or the shoulder, and some manipulation you want to do, or some soft tissue work you want to do, or just some movement pattern correction, I wish that was more acceptable. Because as of now, I mean, depending on your state practice act, you know, I've been licensed now in 7 states, and every single one of them is different. If you're not seen by them, or it's not signed by a physician, then you can only see them for 3 weeks, or it's unlimited, or what have you. I wish that was just so much more acceptable for you to go and see somebody. And I think a lot of times that's why people end up going the route of seeing a massage therapist. They don't need a referral to go to them, or for most chiros or whatnot. So
I had an issue with that today with one of the patients that Will and I saw. He'd had an ankle sprain 14 years prior and had been dealing with issues since then. I'd seen multiple therapists, but basically you said everything revolved around like 4-way ankle with a TheraBand. And literally you look at his dorsiflexion and he's got a talocrural joint restriction. We work on that. We work on his squat pattern, his deadlift technique. We get him squatting and deadlifting, and he's doing that pain-free for the first time in years. And because of his stinking insurance, because I see him like once every 3 weeks and tell him, hey, here are your next steps to work on, they authorize his plan of care for like 6 weeks or 9 weeks or something like that. Well, heck, I didn't know that. I'm treating him the way I think is going to be his best long-term solution, and me coaching him through what he needs to do to take ownership of this. Instead, if I could go back, I'd say, all right, man, your insurance kind of sucks, So they're only going to authorize us for 6 visits. I was going to say that, hey, I'd see you like once every 3 weeks for about, you know, 5 visits. And so over the course of the next several months, we'll make long-term changes. Maybe I should have seen him every week for those 6 weeks, even though I didn't need to see him every week, just so I could get more visits in and more potential to do certain things to speed it up.
So what are ways we can come around that? Because I was actually thinking of this the other day. You know, if you have your own clinic, do you, you know, with certain laws, like here in California, where I'm at now, you can see somebody for 45 days or 12 sessions of direct access before they have to be seen by somebody else. And then when you factor in insurance and what they require, you know, do you just write a plan of care and set it for, you know, the talocrural joint, and then boom, that runs you out after 45 days. You do a new plan of care for subtalar, boom, you know, 45 days. Like, do you do it that route? Is that a way that we can get around it in the interim so we can still be seeing people and treat them the way that we know that is most effective and most beneficial for them? Because me personally, I'm tired of treating for insurance companies. I want to treat them.
I don't know the right answer to that. That's one for somebody that's for people that are making much bigger policy changes than I'm doing right now. It's complicated legally in a lot of ways.
Sure. And
I don't know what the right solution there is.
But it does, but you would say it needs to change.
Yes. But we've done plenty of stuff ourselves as a profession that have not earned us the right to deserve some of those changes when we have too many physical therapy clinics out there that are treating 6 patients at once, 1 therapist, 2 techs, or that are telling people that you need to come in here twice a week for 3 weeks for me to treat your plantar fasciitis, fasciopathy. Sorry, guys, it's the wrong word. So in a lot of ways, our greed or our lack of being willing to accept better treatment plans for a lot of clinics, I think would mean that they don't deserve that.
Yeah.
I don't know if the right answer is to go to performance-based payment plans, which I don't think are going to happen. But, you know, there's plenty of subpar therapies out there that don't deserve to have longer plan of cares and need to be cut off by an insurance company. But there are certainly people that I think do deserve to have certain rights to treat how they best see fit.
Sure. I've been on mall. I was actually not recently in a clinic where you, as the evaluating therapist, you pretty much evaluated them and they were pretty much seen the whole time by techs, except for maybe part of the treatment. Like here in California, the law, the Practice Act actually states they just need to be in contact with me. But even an aide can do manual therapy, corrective exercises, you name it. They can do anything and I can bill for it.
Well, there's somebody that doesn't deserve to have some more progressive changes.
That's
companies that are choosing to treat that way.
Sure.
What would you say, like, someone, go ahead, Joey.
I was going to say, I feel like we can go down this rabbit hole so long. Let's get back to a barbell. I like barbelling. Weights. Let's do caffeine and kilos. Let's go to that. That sounds much more, much better.
What's your favorite lift?
Right now, it's probably the back squat as far as barbell-based movements. I don't know. It changes a lot. Back squat's probably number one, but that's just because I hit a big PR.
PR on that and deadlift?
Usually I hate back squats, but yeah. I hit a big PR.
What was the PR?
415.
Hell yeah. So what was the deadlift?
Deadlift was 455. Deadlift is not a strong suit of mine. And I was getting very close to a 300-pound bench. And I popped a pec doing – I was shooting videos for Instagram. I was doing ring dips.
Uh-oh.
Did 2 of them. Popped my pec. And I regularly do weighted ring dips with tons of weight and – you know, I've performed a set of 50 ring dips unbroken, but popped on a set of 2.
That sounds so like that was
I'd hit 275 for 2 sets of 2. So I was definitely knocking on 300's door. So that was disappointing, but
that sounds I'm like back CrossFit at it regionals a few years ago.
Yeah.
I read your article that you had written on that.
Dude, that article is crazy. All right. So all these athletes 2 years ago in CrossFit Regionals are tearing pecs, all these male athletes. I dreamed this article. Literally dreamed it. Woke up, pulled up some research studies by Tim Gabbett that I had thought about in my dream. Woke up, researched it, drove to work thinking about it. And I was like, crap, this dream was on point. Got to work, wrote the article, put it out.
It was like it was meant to be.
That's when you know you're on point running your website. When you're dreaming your articles, life is good. That's only happened once.
Yeah.
I hope it happens again. I don't know if I like had some crazy cocktail the night before or what. I wish I could remember. That makes the that would make it a lot easier.
So what was the conclusion that, just for the listeners who haven't read it, what was the conclusion in the article as to what you thought the cause was?
So Tim Gabbett's research has looked at this, what they call acute to chronic workload ratio. Basically how much work you do in 1 week compared to the 4 weeks beforehand. And they found that there's these certain ratios that are correlated with injuries happening. And when you train at significantly higher training volumes than you're used to, a lot of times that's when injuries occur. And so if you're looking at what the average CrossFit Regionals level athlete does, you know, maybe once a week they'll do a workout that has muscle ups. Maybe occasionally they'll do a workout that has dips in it, but they don't practice dips a whole lot because dips aren't a skill that at that level is very hard. That's not going to be an exercise that wins or loses you, because it's pretty daggone easy when you're at a certain point in CrossFit.
Mm-hmm.
So then these workouts come up that have, I think they had a couple workouts that had muscle ups in it. They had one workout that had a lot of ring dips in it. And so these workouts are announced ahead of time. So the athletes have several weeks before the regionals to repeatedly practice these workouts. And my belief is just that they ended up practicing those workouts. And I spoke to several CrossFit regionals level athletes and people that coach these athletes. And like, yeah, we probably practiced that workout four times in the 2 weeks before the regionals. Like, so you did a four ring dip workouts, then go to regionals and do another one. So you've probably done five heavy ring dip workouts plus muscle up work in a stressful situation when you're not used to doing that volume of that particular movement pattern where your shoulder's in an extreme extension position going down to neutral flexion. And so I think that acute to chronic workload ratio was so high that it just led to a lot of pec injuries.
What I was interested in was who was diagnosing all of these pec tears?
They do have a pretty extensive medical staff and all other things. I would say that the popular media was probably diagnosing them all as pec tears when a lot of them were probably pec strains. I don't know how many of them were actual complete tears.
Yeah, because I was like, that question came into my head after one of the high-level regionals athletes tore his pec, quote-unquote, dropped out of the competition, and then the next day competed in the USAW weightlifting thing and did a max snatch. And I was like, what is happening? Who said that your pec is torn if you're doing a max snatch? Like, you know, so was it pec major, pec minor, both? Do we know?
I don't know. I never dug specifically into each individual athlete's injury.
Yeah.
Mine was pec major.
Whenever you
write it, like the clavicular head.
So how did you rehab that? You rehabbed it yourself?
Yeah, I rehabbed it myself. Initially, I did have some coworkers like twice do a little soft tissue work. Just because initially it was really painful. Like day one, I could not wash my hands without 6 out of 10 pain. And day one, I went to the bathroom, took my shirt off, looked at my pec probably 10 times because I was legitimately worried that there was going to be actual tearing in the muscle.
Yeah.
With how much it was hurting at that time. I couldn't do a push-up initially, so I started with bench press. I would lay on my back, pull the bar down to the position where I felt about a 3 out of 10 pain, and did isometrics. And that was my first few days. Eventually, I got to where I could press the barbell through full range of motion with minor pain. And then I started just building that weight up. When I started to feel like I was actually pushing a little bit of weight, so like I was a week out, I was able to do 95 pounds if I used a reverse band. So the band basically had the bar almost empty at the bottom, and then I had 95 pounds on me at the top. So that the area of the injury where I was most vulnerable, I was most protected with. And then a couple weeks later, You know, I'm benching 135 pounds through full range of motion, which for me is a really light weight. So I would bench and I would increase my weight for like sets of 5 to 10, whatever I was feeling like doing that day through full range of motion. And when I got to the point where my pain at a certain weight was a 3 out of 10, I would then do block bench press. So a board bench press. Mm-hmm. So I put a board on my chest that basically didn't take me into in range stretch there. And that would allow me to then load up much heavier. Mm-hmm. So maybe the first day I was doing 135 pounds through full range of motion before I started to get about 3 out of 10 pain. And then I would go board press 185 and I'd be able to crank out 185 for like 20 reps. And then I just follow that path where every day I build up through full range of motion to the most weight I can handle with minor pain, or every time I worked out, I didn't do it every day. And then I would use partial range of motion for heavier weight. I did a lot of accessory work. So I did a lot of deltoid work, a lot of tricep work. I did some blood flow restriction training stuff. I think that's close to all I did. I did a whole series on Instagram basically showing every treatment option that I did from a loading perspective to try to maintain my strength as much as possible as I progress back. And you know, I'm 2 weeks into being back on like a full training plan with no modifications, hitting the weights that I actually would have expected to be hitting. Like, I haven't maxed. I'm back to like really high volume work, but I'm doing volume work with weights that basically reflect if I was bench pressing 295 pounds. What I felt like I for sure could hit 295 pre-injury. So mm-hmm. I based my current weights off of that rather than dropping that number down to like a injured status. And I'm hitting the volume work at those numbers. So I'm going to be good. I'm going to hit 300 in 4 months. I'm going to hit more than 300 in 4 months. I'm going to hit 315 in 4 months.
I get you there in two.
I'm saying it on a podcast.
There you go.
Speaking it out.
So, speaking of which, I'm trying to make a mental image here. What sort of technique do you use with benching? I'm guessing you're talking about the barbell.
Yes.
As a power lifter.
Oh, no, that's a one-arm dumbbell press with 300 pounds is what I'm going for. I am that strong.
That's awesome. Now, as a power lifter I do both raw classic and quipped. With a quip, they'll talk about straight sleeve is where the elbows flare out, which where you get actually more stretch of the pec major, or where probably 85% of people do, where they actually tuck the elbows in and they try to set the shoulder. Do you do more of that route, or which one do you go for?
Yeah, I'm the second route. I don't go elbows wide. My shoulders don't tolerate that very well.
See, I'm the exact opposite. My shoulders, I can do so much more with flaring my elbows out. And I feel like at least with a muscle specificity, I get so much more of a contraction out of the pec major with flaring.
I should say I'm also stronger there. This is the second time I popped my pec. Same one. And after the first one, that one was actually a little bit worse. Actually, you can see a divot in my pec at its attachment onto the sternum. You can see a divot where it's actually pulled away on the bottom part of the pec. And that was from back in high school. I did that doing dips too. Mm-hmm. So maybe dips aren't the right exercise for me. But because of that, and having seen a lot of people with that flared elbow bench press tear their pecs, I've always kind of been worried about it. And every time I have done that since then, I just always felt like I'd get more like rotator cuffy issues. Mm-hmm. So even though I'm stronger there, I came down, which has also helped because my triceps are incredibly weak. So it's putting me in a position where I have to build those up more.
So would you say that kind of varies per someone's personal anatomy or lifting preference?
Everybody's technique is going to vary for every lift based on their personal anatomy. Absolutely. And every technique is going to place certain loads or increase stress on certain tissues. So you want to squat with your knees forward? That's fine. It is going to put a little bit more pressure on your knees. It's going to take a lot of pressure off your hips and low back. So if you want to squat with vertical shins and your knees back, understand that, yeah, that's going to take a little pressure off your knees, according to some research, about 22%, but it's going to put about 1,000% more on your hips and low back. So every little change that you make in your technique is just changing where some of those stressors go.
And the most optimal way varies for that person. That person's lengths. Because some people...
The most optimal way varies for that person, but I also think that there's something to be said about varying the way that you do certain lifts. And so maybe if you're a CrossFitter and a workout's coming up that has 50 squats, you know, it might be smart to do some of your squats with your knees really going forward. There might be some of them where it's smart to go hip stand back a little bit. Mm-hmm. Knees go forward, your quads are probably going to get a little bit tired sooner. Sit back a little bit more. Then you're going to let your quads have a little bit of relaxation while you put a little bit more of the loaded stress onto your hips. And that might be a way to get through more volume there by strategizing how you're using that.
So like an intro workout variability?
Yeah. Or I'm a big fan of using varying my accessory work or my main lifts regularly, just so that I'm stressing the same tissue slightly differently over time.
Yeah.
There's research in the running world that wearing two pairs of shoes during the course of a week is going to decrease your risk of injuries. Just that change alone, the minor changes that's going to make and stressors to you. I think the same is probably true in some ways for lifting athletes, that if we make more variants happen in people's programs to a certain extent, we're going to allow them to not overload certain tissues. You also can't vary so much that you're no longer specific in your training.
Yeah.
So there's a fine line between it.
Yeah, you got to toe the line.
Mm-hmm. That's something I actually found. When I squat, I used to only do it in ollies. I was only doing it in the Olympic shoes. And then, you know, as I got more and more to competing, and once I broke that 500-pound squat, it was much harder to stay erect in my back without it feeling like it was going to dump, because I do have a spondy. I have a spondylolisthesis. What?
You just rubbed it in that you squatted more than me? You did that on purpose. You've been wanting to drop 500.
The whole time. You have no idea.
Oh, no, you did that equipped. That doesn't count. That's cheating. Equipped lifters, yeah. You can't lift anything, man. That's probably like a 200-pound squat.
No, that one wasn't equipped. I have done – I've never squatted equipped. So I've only done benched equipped. But no, but that's actually very true with changing your running shoes, though, because if I'm squatting twice a week, if I do ollies, I'll do it once, and then I'll do flats another day. And they're very different techniques. And the thing that I found, especially when hitting heavy weights, if you are halfway down on a squat, and you need to make changes in the middle of a squat, you know, you can't pick your foot up and move it over in the middle. You got to be able to adjust on the fly.
Yeah. So something we were talking about with Will, I was showing him kind of how I assessed the hip earlier today. And we kind of found the pocket where his hip has the most available range of motion. And, you know, in that pocket, because Will has great hip external rotation, I feel like if he could get some improvements in his internal rotation, it would give him a little bit more room to play. So that when he, especially as somebody doing Olympic lifts, when he catches that lift slightly out of position, his joint has more available range of motion to move through when he's not in his perfect positions.
Having that variability and being able to control it.
Mm-hmm.
Would you say that's the best way that we know currently with the evidence in order to decrease injury rates besides the flip of a coin?
The variability, I don't know in the lifting community that's been proven. Mm-hmm. And even in the running community, I don't know if that's been proven besides, you know, one study on that. I think where probably the most research, more than anything, is coming from is just needing to look at overall training volume. That you're not overly taxing what your body's able to recover from. I think that's probably going to be more important than any little biomechanical details that we could talk about that could influence somebody's injury risk.
So on the sheets that you give, or on the exercises you give to your clients or patients, you know, if you give it to them written out, or say a Google Doc or Excel sheet, is there a part on there where it actually gives the total volume of what they're doing for that workout or for that week, so they can actually see that, hey, you know, you went from a total of, let's just say, 3,000 pounds that you lifted to now you're hitting 5,000 the next week?
So if I'm going to have somebody calculate workload, especially for me with a high percentage of CrossFitters, mm-hmm. and Olympic lifters and power lifters, where different exercises, while you might can quantify their load, their the variances in certain exercises is going to make that difficult to be even. Like a Zercher squat compared to a back squat. How do I quantify, you know, a Zercher squat with 200 pounds compared to a back squat with 300 pounds? Mm-hmm. Which one's harder? We don't really know. And you can't go just on poundages alone. So I think you kind of have to look at session-based RPE. On a scale of 0 to 10, tell me how hard you thought that exercise session was. How long was it? All right, it was 50 minutes long. And on a scale of 0 to 10, I felt like it was an 8 out of 10. All right, that's 400 session-based RPE points. And that's how I would generally say, if we're trying to really calculate training volume, that's going to be probably the best measurement that we have right now. I made that argument in a conference a couple months back, and professor raised his hand and said, no, that's easy. You calculate the distance the weight is from the moment arm calculated by the mass that you're moving, and you can calculate that for every lift that you do. I was like, yeah, that's going to work out really well for my CrossFitter who's going to have to calculate that for his Fran time and his max snatch the next day.
Yeah, but that's also dependent on what
– it's going to be the easiest way to possibly do that.
And RPE stands for what?
Rating of perceived exertion. Okay. So on a scale of 0 to 10, how hard do you perceive that exercise session was? 0 is not even hard at all. 10 is that was the hardest workout that I could imagine doing. And then you multiply that by how much time you spent doing it.
I would say I've only ever experienced a 10, maybe twice. Did you do the CrossFit Open workout in 2015? I think it was 15.5 with the thrusters in the row.
Thrusters in row, yeah.
Yeah.
That was a 9. I'd say the last time I did Fran was a 10, and the time I did German volume training back squats was a 10. I can't think of another workout
that was 10. That's 10 sets of 10?
10 sets of 10. And I want to say it's with 50% of your one rep max. Which I was sore as crap last week from doing 5 sets of 10 with 60% of my one rep max. So 10 by 10 at 50% was brutal.
Yeah. After that 15.5 workout, I was on the ground for 45 minutes.
That's how I was after Fran. I was like literally yelling at my coach, I'm going to have rhabdo. He's like, no, you're not. You're fine. You've done plenty of pull-ups, plenty of thrusters, and now I thought I was going to die. I was about to be in tears. I never want to do that again.
Yeah. Fran's mean. 21.59 thrusters and pull-ups.
I was trying to break 4, and I went all out to try to break it, and I didn't even break it. It was horrible.
She got you.
Yeah. I think it was 4 I was trying to break. It may have been 5. It was a long time ago. I really haven't tried that workout. It's been 4 years since I've tried it. 3 years since I've tried it. I don't want
to. You guys are literally making me want to try CrossFit. Because I don't even have a clue what you're talking about.
You won't, Joseph. I just explained the workout, 21.59, thrusters and pull-ups.
So what does that mean, 21.59? You do 2,159 of them?
No, it's not a year. You do 21 thrusters, 21 pull-ups, 15 thrusters, 15 pull-ups, 9-9.
How much weight?
95 pounds.
What? So you mean hip thruster?
No.
Front squat to overhead press.
That's okay.
One movement.
Okay.
This power lifter.
So it's, you know, it's a lightweight and it's a body weight pull up, which for most CrossFitters of a certain level, neither one of those alone are bad. And it's a low rep scheme, but the muscle groups you use with a thruster, a front squat and overhead press, don't match at all the muscles that you use with a pull up. So it's one of those workouts that just lets you go and go and go and go as fast as you can for a short period of time to where you're just having to bust it. And no individual muscle group is ever fully smoked, but your whole stinking body is completely smoked at the same time. It's weird. Can't describe it until you try it. It's a horrible workout.
Seriously makes me want to do it.
I think you should.
I think you should film it, and that should be your first IGTV.
I really want to do it next to you, and I just want to see – me versus you. My biggest thing, though, I don't even know if I can do a front squat, to be honest. I never actually do them.
You'll just have to get your heels really elevated on something.
So
you can do the workout in stilettos, Joey.
Oh, make me look tall for once.
I had a specific. Oh, so I asked Ryan Smith this question.
Okay.
I want to ask you the question.
What was the answer first?
It's the question's about kipping pull-ups.
Mm-hmm.
What would you say to internet trolls who hate on CrossFit for kipping pull-ups?
I've written an article on it. Oh, already done it, man. thebarbellphysio.com, the truth about kipping pull-ups. What would I say? I think most people's understanding of what a kipping pull-up from the standpoint first, it's just untrue. I think it's a cheating pull-up, and it's not. We CrossFit headquarters, not individual CrossFit gyms, but CrossFit headquarters considers it a vastly different exercise than the standard pull-up.
Mm-hmm.
So we need to understand that at first. Then people talk about it being an uncontrolled flailing exercise, which it's not. If you look at what the articles I wrote in CrossFit Journal on the kipping pull-up, or what CrossFit itself puts out on the kipping pull-up or the kip, it is a very controlled movement, and it should be very controlled. Now, we do see a lot of individuals in certain gyms choosing to do kipping pull-ups before they have the necessary prerequisites to do it, before they have a proper kip, before they have proper strength with strict pull-ups. And that's one thing I would like to change about it.
Yeah.
But that is at an individual athlete basis or a gym basis on them choosing to do the wrong things. CrossFit headquarters, CrossFit Gymnastic, CrossFit Journal are all putting out material talking about being smart about how you program this exercise. Then the next argument people make is about it being, you know, it's an orthopedic surgeon's retirement fund. I've had somebody tell me that. It's like kipping pull-ups itself are an orthopedic surgeon's retirement fund.
It's like a death wish.
Well, I mean, if you just as a whole, if you look at the injury rates in CrossFit compared to other recreational fitness activities, research has proven time and time again, as long as it was research not fraudulently put out by the NSCA, that if you haven't heard about that, look for CrossFit sues the NSCA and read this stuff, especially if you're an NSCA member and you're believing every single thing that they say to you, you need to check that stuff out. Not that they haven't done some great stuff for the strength and conditioning world, but what they did there was crap.
Yeah.
What was that? If you look at the research on injury rates in CrossFit compared to other recreational fitness activities, it's exactly on par with other recreational fitness activities. So while we don't have specific data saying that CrossFit kipping pull-ups are more dangerous, we can look at a whole at CrossFit, which does use kipping pull-ups to a good extent, not having increased injury over other forms of recreational fitness activities. So I just don't think that the research currently supports the fact that those are dangerous. I certainly do think that there are steps that we could take to make them a safer exercise. But let's be honest, anytime we add more load or more speed or more dynamics to a movement, injury risk goes up.
Yeah.
Are you going to get injured more when you walk or when you run? Probably when you run.
Very true.
Are you going to get injured more if you're squatting 25 pounds in the physical therapy clinic or when you're in a clinic where somebody's going to be willing to put more weight on you? Probably in a clinic or gym where somebody's going to put more weight on you. It's
shots
just what
fired.
Happens. It's what happens. Good grief. Let's get
so
over it.
So you're saying you should load a patient more than just like a TheraBand?
If you're not getting people to a 7 to 8 out of 10 RPE at some point in their rehab plan, then you are not sufficiently loading them to create an adaptive response in the human body.
Oof. Preach it.
For some people, that could be a TheraBand.
For some people, it absolutely could. And I use TheraBands a lot, but you better have something more than a TheraBand in your clinic, or you better have a really good exercise database in your mind.
That's a good point.
Yeah, I think every
place. But some people say that I don't have the clinic, the equipment necessary in my clinic to get people better, Will.
Really?
As I told you today.
You have kettlebells, a barbell.
One of my local PT friends has been telling people that I don't have the equipment necessary in my clinic to get patients better.
I disagree.
So they just trying to defer them from you?
Yeah.
Unbelievable.
So, wrapping up here, we're going to ask the question that we've asked most of our podcastees. What is the one thing that is your core mission to fix in the healthcare world? Say, if you never had to hear a patient tell you this blank again because it was no longer a thing or it was a society level sliver of knowledge.
I think I think too many people have a frail mindset about the human body and think that it's like a fragile piece of glass. So for Will and I, as believers and people of faith, I don't believe that God created the human body to be so fragile that, that minute biomechanical abnormalities are making people destroyed. Mm-hmm. Like you lacking some hip internal rotation. Well, it can affect some things. Like we don't need people going around thinking that that's what's going to destroy their body or that a disc herniation is. If we want to talk about this from like an evolution perspective, if you're not somebody that has a faith-based belief, I don't believe that the human body would have made it to this point at the top of the food chain, the species that is controlling the world, if we were that fragile. The human body is robust and can heal and adapt. And if more people had that mindset, that the rehab process and the medical world as a whole would be in a lot better shape. But we keep getting in the way of the human body healing.
So it's kind of independent upon your beliefs. Like it's just overall, the human body is very robust.
That's something I say to patients all the time. I use that analogy. I say, like, do you believe in God? Do you believe in evolution because of these reasons? I don't ask them the question. I just say, like,
yeah,
hey, based on your beliefs, like, just think about it this way. Like, your body should be able to heal and should be able to adapt to these things.
Yeah.
Or else we never would have made it to this point.
Right. Fair enough. Joseph, you got anything else?
Oh, no, I could talk for days. When can I come?
Anytime, man.
All right. Thank you so much for your time. Really appreciate everything.
Enjoy it, guys.
Thanks for coming on the Alinea Life podcast. I don't know if that's going to be the conclusion or not.
Sure. I sure hope not.
Thank you so much for listening. Follow us for more content on Instagram and Facebook at the Alinea Collective and our website, thealineacollective.com. Additional platforms you can download the podcast include iTunes, SoundCloud, Stitcher, Player FM, or wherever else you get your podcasts. New episodes dropping weekly.